sure it's a gambling term, said the artiste, but I'm not so sure the game is poker. More sniggers and guffaws. Everybody at both ends of the table knew that when a developer obtained a loan commitment from a bank, the bank released the money to him in stages, and the first stage was known as the first draw. There was a motto among the developers in Atlanta, buy the boat with the first draw, which meant, buy the 74-foot Hatteras motor yacht you've always wanted, the house on Sea Island you've been dreaming of, the condominium in Vail, the ranch in Wyoming, with that first release of money, just in case something goes wrong and you don't make any profit on the project. Strictly speaking, using the first draw that way was illegal. Fraudulent, in a word, since in the loan agreement, the developer promised to devote every nickel to the project. But in the heady days of the late 1980s, and then again in the late 1990s, the banks had winked and looked the other way. And there were, in point of fact, quite a few boats named First Draw moored on Sea Island and at Hilton Head. And there was a stallion down in Baker County. First Draw, said the artiste in his W.C. Fields voice. Yowza, yowza. Is it also a fact, Mr. Croker, that you ride some of those 59 horses while you shoot quail at turpentine? Well, you best get off of 'em first before you shoot a shotgun or you'll regret it. But certainly you ride out to the fields, and it's good for the horses. The artiste eyed the shithead dubiously. 59 horses. $4,700,000. Then he looked down at the sheets in front of him. 29,000 acres, land, improvements, and equipment. A 5,000-foot concrete runway capable of accommodating a Gulfstream V jet aircraft. Total value, $32 million. All told, with the horses, that's $37 million right there. He paused, then said in his dead-even voice, "Sell 'em."
"Sell what?"
"The plantation and the horses. The works." Now Croker paused. He squinted into the glare, as if to see the artiste better. "For the moment, I'm going to leave aside the importance of turpentine to the future of our corporation, and I'm going to mention two other things." The old man seemed to have decided to take the reasonable approach. "First, this is not the time in the real estate cycle to put a 29,000-acre farm on the market, but I'm sure you know that. Second, turpentine is not just a farm. It's an institution, a very remarkable institution." The old man's voice was suddenly warm and resonant. He launched into a passionate account of turpentine's history, with some more about the turpentine people. He told of how Croker Global was today one of the biggest employers of unskilled black labor in that part of Georgia. He told of black workers tending the plats, black workers tending the horses, black workers tilling the soil, black workers preserving the ecology of Turpentine's 8,000 acres of swamp. You could hear his voice welling up toward a peroration.
"Nobody else is going to employ these people the way we do. Nobody but Croker Global is going to have experimental plats and agrochemical experiments and a horse operation and peanuts, cotton, timber, and an ecological program."
"And quail shooting," said the artiste.
"Yeah, all right, quail shooting. That provides employment for these people, too. We got some black dog trainers, and they're damn good at it. We got people tending the dogs and the horses and the copses and the wagons and everything else. Now, if Croker Global pulled out, sold out, where would these people go? I'll tell you. On welfare. We're talking about southwest Georgia here, out in the country, the real country. And these folks don't just go off to some other job. These are good, proud folks who don't want to be on the dole. These are good country folks who see welfare as a stigma. These are turpentine folks who count on Croker Global as the one steady rock in their lives. so there's no way you or me or anybody else can look at Turpentine as just some asset to be capitalized or liquidated. There's a dimension here you can't put in a financial statement, a dimension that involves pain and suffering, that involves a human cost.
"Hey, wait a minute," said Harry, lifting both hands, palms outward, and casting his eyes down in the gesture that says, "Please, no more." "I understand pain. I understand suffering. I understand the human cost."
Now he looked up, straight at Croker, with a gaze that bespoke the utmost sincerity.
"I've been there. I was in the war. I lost four fingers."
With that he raised his right fist above his head as high as it would go, with the back of his hand twisted toward Croker, so that it looked like a stump of a hand with only the ridges of the four big knuckles remaining. Then he extended a single finger upward, his middle finger, and kept it that way, a look of quizzical sadness on his face.
"Sell it," he said.
Croker stared at the upright middle finger, and squinted, and stared some more, and his face grew red. And then Peepgas saw them. The saddlebags. The saddlebags! The saddlebags had formed. They were complete. The great stains of sweat on the tycoon's shirt had now spread from both sides, from under the arms and across the rib cage and beneath the curves of his mighty chest, until they had met, come together, hooked up, two dark expanses joined at the sternum. They looked just like a pair of saddlebags on a horse. Oh, Peepgas loved it. Harry had done it again, gotten his saddlebags, even with a tough old bird like Charlie Croker. Fellows here at the Planner's Bank end of the table were nudging each other and smiling. They'd noticed it, too. Peepgas was elated. Somehow Harry had redeemed them all. He turned toward the artiste and said, behind his hand, "Saddlebags, Harry. Saddlebags." He meant it to be sotto voce, little more than a whisper, but it came out much too loud. He hadn't meant to grin, either, but he did. He couldn't hold back. He could see Croker staring at him. The artiste lowered his arm, and Croker began to sputter. His voice was low and deep in his throat. "Now listen," he began. In a perfectly pleasant voice, Harry Zale said, "Just a moment, Mr. Croker." And he leaned over toward Peepgas and said in a low voice, "Time for a little lender's cactus, wouldn't you say?" Peepgas chuckled. "Perfect," he said. "Oh, God, this would be rich." Harry straightened up and looked at Croker and arched his eyebrows. "Now you listen," Croker resumed, his voice lost somewhere deep in his trachea. "Excuse me, Mr. Croker," said the artiste, "but we're going to have a lender's cactus now. So we're going to ask you gentlemen and you ladies to step outside the room so we can cactus."
"You're going to what?"
asked Croker.
"We're going to have a lender's cactus."
"Did you say cactus?" asked Croker.
"Right," said the artiste. "So if you'll just step outside for a little while, we'll appreciate it."
"Are you trying to say caucus?" Croker was all but snarling.
"No, cactus," said the artiste with a merry smile. "This time we want all the pricks on the outside."
The artiste kept the smile spread across his face, as if this was all good boys' locker room fun. The tycoon stared with as furious a scowl as Peepgas had ever seen on a man's face. All that the artiste gave him was the big, unblinking grin. 10 kinds of mayhem must have been going through Croker's mind, but he said nothing. Slowly he rose, and Wismer Strook and the rest of his retinue rose with him. The long-legged bird, Peaches, now standing beside him, stared at the old man's shirt. For the first time, Croker seemed to be aware that it was a sopping mess. He glanced down morosely at his saddlebags, then picked up his jacket and wheeled about,
and started walking out of the room. He took a step, and then when he took a second step, his entire huge body seemed to buckle and collapse to starboard before he could right himself. Then he took another step, and then another, and the same thing happened again. Evidently something was terribly wrong with his right knee or his right hip. The whole room was watching. On he walked toward the door, taking a normal step and then buckling, taking a normal step and then buckling. It made it seem as if the drubbing he had just suffered at the hands of Harry Zale had taken some terrible physical toll on his body. Then he stopped and paused for a moment. Slowly he turned about. He stared balefully, but not at Harry Zale. He stared at Peep Gas himself, and with a hissing stage whisper he said, "Asshole!" All at once Peep Gas was aware that now everybody in the room, at both ends of the table, was looking at him. They were waiting for him to respond. But he was stunned, speechless. And, more than that, he was afraid. What did he dare say to this enraged bull down at the other end of the table? A moment ago he had been so elated, reveling as the artiste had reduced the great tycoon to a sweating, sputtering, groggy, humiliated shithead. A moment ago he had felt redeemed, avenged against Croker and his entire saber-toothed ilk. And now he stood here, paralyzed, while a scalding realization spread through the very lining of his skull. "I can't take this man on. Not even verbally. Not even when he's thrown such an insult. Asshole, right in my face in front of my own people." And he stood there, unable to make a sound, while his face burned and his heart pounded. Croker shook his head disdainfully and turned away, and continued his gimp-legged retreat from the room, taking a step and buckling, taking a step and buckling, taking a step and buckling, taking a step and buckling. Peep Gas just stood there, frozen, speechless, afraid to look into the eyes of anybody else in the room. Chapter 3 Turpentine. By noon, Charlie Croker was sitting in his favorite seat in the forward cabin of his Gulfstream V, as the two BMW Rolls-Royce engines roared and the aircraft lifted off from PDK. His right knee still hurt, and he was burning up, but he kept his jacket on because he didn't want the ship's only other passenger, Wismer Strook, looking at his shirt. "Saddlebags!" Ray Peep Gas had exclaimed. And by now Charlie had figured out that insolent wisecrack. The shirt was still wet beneath the arms and across the ribs. The saddlebags wouldn't go away. Wismer Strook was seated facing him. Between the two of them was Charlie's pride and joy, a desktop that had been custom-made out of a slab of Tupelo Mabel from Turpentine Plantation, and cantilevered from the G5's wall by stainless steel supports. The Wiz was only 32, but he had a bony neck and a bony jaw, and sunken cheeks, and cadaverous cheekbones from getting up every morning, before dawn, and running 6 miles through the streets of a Dunwoody subdivision called Quail Ridge. The rectangular titanium frames of the Wiz's eyeglasses made his eyes look like a pair of barcode scanners. At this moment, the barcode scanners were aimed out the window, as if the Wiz were absorbed in the process of takeoff or the G5's distinctive white wing with its rudder-like upturned tip. In fact, Charlie could tell that his young chief financial officer was embarrassed for him and didn't want to humiliate him any further by even so much as contemplating his face. That meant he must have really looked bad over at Planner's Bank. The head remained in profile, but the two barcode scanners rotated toward him for an instant, and so Charlie decided to put an end to the tension. "Okay, Wiz, got any good ideas?"
He tried to boom his voice out over the noise of the engines. Now the Wiz looked straight at him and opened his mouth, but no words came out. Instead, he held his fingertips up to his ears, as if it was too noisy to hear, and looked away again. So Charlie looked away, too, and tried to buck himself up by considering the glories of his surroundings, namely the G5 and its wonderful appurtenances. The cabin's dozen seats were big as thrones and upholstered in the richest tan leather imaginable, and placed at conspicuously wasteful intervals, like chairs in a club lounge. There were curtains and carpeting woven with Croker Global's navy and gold globe logo, and custom-made consoles with the logo carved on the doors in relief so deep people couldn't resist running their fingers over it. There were Skywatch screens they could see from any seat they sat in, as a tiny white airplane shape moved across an electronic map and showed them precisely where they were flying, anywhere in the world. But what really got them was Charlie's desktop. It had been fashioned from a single slab of wood, 4 or 5 inches thick, cut from the knee of a black tupelo maple tree from Juker's Swamp at Turpentine, the knee being the part of the tree that swelled out just above the waterline. The desk retained the irregular shape and rugged edge of the slab as it was originally cut, although it was all highly polished and the top was like glass, with the burled swirls of the grain creating an extraordinary design. The desk was actually the brainchild of Ronald Vine, the decorator Serena had insisted he bring down to Atlanta from New York to do the G5's interior. But Charlie loved that desk so much, there were days when he believed the original idea, the germ of the inspiration, must have been his. He loved it so much, he had had Ronald, Charlie had actually grown to admire and enjoy the guy, make a much larger version of it as a dining table for the new hunting lodge at Turpentine, the gunhouse, that Ronald had designed and built last year, at a cost, to Croker Global Foods, of $3.6 million by the time it was all over. Ronald had also paneled the bulkheads of the G5 with tupelo maple. It was lighter and warmer and livelier than the usual stiff-necked mahogany. On the bulkhead facing Charlie, the one right behind the Wiz's seat, Ronald had affixed the ornate gold frame of the greatest work of art in the history of the world, so far as Charlie Croker was concerned, and Charlie was staring at it right now. It was a painting, by N.C. Wyeth, of Jim Bowie rising up from his deathbed to fight the Mexicans at the Alamo. Wyeth had done it in reds, oranges, tans, blacks, and whites, as the frontispiece for Lone Star, a child's history of Texas that was the only book Charlie could remember his father and mother ever possessing. The day in 1986 when he bought that painting, the one he was staring at right now, for $190,000 at an auction at Sotheby's up in New York City, had been one of the happiest days of his entire life. And this was already one of the worst days of his entire life, and it was only 12 noon. Humiliation. Well, let's face facts. The whole thing had been humiliating from start to finish. That son of a bitch, Zale, or whatever his name was, the smart guy with the big chin, had humiliated him in a whole room full of people, including 11 of his own people from his own office. He had given him the finger. He had called him a prick. He had compared him to some drunk fool peeing in the street during Freaknik. And he had had to grit his teeth and take it. On the way out, gimping along on his bad knee like an old man, he had annihilated this Zell or Zale 4 or 5 times. On the elevator going down, he had thrown both hands up toward the son of a bitch's face in a feint. And when the son of a bitch had lifted his own hands in defense,
He had grabbed him around the waist in a bear hug and squeezed with every ounce of the strength of his mighty arms and his massive back. "I've got a back like a Jersey bull." Until the son of a bitch's backbone cracked and he started whimpering for mercy. "Lost four fingers in the war, did you, you pansy, you cow, you gladiola? Now how about a little joke about losing your very life?" Between Planner's Bank's marble mausoleum of a lobby and his car, which was in the tower's parking garage, he had destroyed the son of a bitch three or four more times in various ways, until he ran out of ideas for committing homicide with his bare hands. And truly, if the son of a bitch had been so unwise as to turn up at that moment, something violent surely would have taken place. As soon as he and Wismer Strook reached the car, Charlie had decided not to go back to the office, and instead told the Wiz to get on the telephone and call the office and have Marguerite get hold of Ludd and Jimmy and Gwinnett, and have them get the Gulfstream ready to fly to Turpentine immediately, and call Durwood to pick them up at the landing strip and have lunch ready in the gunhouse. He wanted to get away to some place quiet to work out a little strategy with the Wiz. Or that was what he told the Wiz, and, for that matter, himself. He insisted on doing the driving out to PDK himself, even though it hurt his knee just to press his foot on the gas pedal. He didn't want the Wiz, or himself, to think he was a totally helpless case. On the way out on the Buford Highway, heading for PDK, he put the car on cruise control as much as he could. His knee hurt that much. And so now, as the aircraft roared and strained to gain altitude, Charlie concentrated on the painting of Jim Bowie and tried to draw strength from it, as he had so many times before in moments of stress. The knee was aching so goddamned much. Oh, he was like a lot of old football players. It had been great and glorious stuff playing football for Tech, for the Ramblin' Wreck back in the 50s and early 60s. And now he was a worn-out, arthritic wreck himself. But that wouldn't have stopped a Jim Bowie. In the painting, Bowie, who was already dying, lay on a bed with a cheap metal bedstead, an old-fashioned infirmary bed. He had propped himself up on one elbow. With his other hand, he was brandishing his famous Bowie knife at a bunch of Mexican soldiers who had burst into the room with rifles and bayonets and were heading for him. It was the way Bowie's big neck and his jaw jutted out toward the Mexicans, and the way his eyes blazed, defiant to the end, that made it a great painting. "Never say die, even when you're dying," was what that painting said. Charlie always wished he could have met N.C. Wyeth and shaken his hand. He stared at the indomitable boy and waited for an infusion of courage. Instead, he felt some sort of disturbing electrical field forming beneath his sternum, around his heart. For an instant, he didn't know what it was. But then he did. Its name was panic. The ship had taken off to the northeast, and the two pilots, Ludd Harnsberger, the captain, and Jimmy Kite, the co-pilot, were executing a big lazy turn to the northwest in order to head back south for the trip down to Turpentine. Gwinnett, the stewardess, must have already gotten up from her seat in the rear, because Charlie heard a refrigerator cabinet or the microwave or something slam shut back in the galley. Gwinnett probably figured she ought to move fast, since it didn't take much more than 30 minutes flying time to reach the plantation. In the distance, the sun was exploding off the towers of downtown and midtown Atlanta, and the commercial swath on the eastern side of Buckhead. Charlie knew them all by sight. He knew them not by the names of their architects— what were architects but neurotic and artistic hired help, but by the names of their developers. There was John Portman's 70-story glass cylinder, the Weston Peachtree Plaza, flashing in the sun. Portman was smart. He was his own architect, There was Tom Cousins's twin-towered 191 Peachtree. There was Blaine Kelly's promenade, too, with all the little neon fins on top. There was Lars Gunstelt's GLG Grand Tower. There was Charlie's own Phoenix Center, and over there, his Moscow Tower. And over there, his Transex Palladium. Palladium. What an innocent time the 1980s had been. There was Mac Taylor and Harvey Mathis's Buckhead Plaza. There was Charlie Ackerman's Tower Place. Downtown, Midtown, and Buckhead were like islands rising from an ocean of trees. Many was the time that the view from up here in the G5, looking down upon the towers and the trees, had filled him with an inexpressible joy.
"I did that. That's my handiwork. I'm one of the giants who built this city. I'm a star."
Total strangers used to say hello to him in restaurants, in malls, at sports events, with a certain glistening look in their eyes, because they knew he was the fabled Charlie Croker. Which made it all the more unbelievable, this thing that had just happened at Planner's Bank. Saddlebags! Such contempt! He looked away from the buildings and out over the ocean of trees. Since Atlanta was not a port city and was, in fact, far inland, the trees stretched on in every direction. They were Atlanta's greatest natural resource, those trees were. People loved to live beneath them. Fewer than 400,000 people lived within the Atlanta city limits, and almost three-quarters of them were black. If anything, over the past decade, Atlanta's population had declined slightly. But for the past 30 years, all sorts of people, most of them white, had been moving in beneath those trees, into all those delightful, leafy, rolling rural communities that surrounded the city proper. By the hundreds of thousands they had come, from all over Georgia, all over the South, all over America, all over the world, into those subdivided hills and downs and glens and glades beneath the trees, until the population of Greater Atlanta was now more than 3.5 million, and they were still pouring in. How fabulous the building booms had been! As the G5 banked, Charlie looked down. There was Spaghetti Junction, as it was known, where Highways 85 and 285 came together in a tangle of 14 gigantic curving concrete and asphalt ramps and 12 overpasses. And now he could see Perimeter Center, where Georgia 400 crossed 285. Mac Taylor and Harvey Mathis had built an office park called Perimeter Center out among all those trees, which had been considered a very risky venture at the time, because it was so far from downtown. And now Perimeter Center was the nucleus around which an entire edge city, known by that very name, Perimeter Center, had grown. Taylor and Mathis had proved to be geniuses. Edge City. Charlie closed his eyes and wished he'd never heard of the damn term. He wasn't much of a reader, but back in 1991, Lucky Putney, another developer, had given him a copy of a book called Edge City by somebody named Joel Garreau. He had opened it up and glanced at it, and couldn't put it down, even though it was 500 pages long. He had experienced the aha phenomenon. The book put into words something he and other developers had felt instinctively for quite a while, namely that from now on, the growth of American cities was going to take place not in the heart of the metropolis, not in the old downtown or midtown, but out on the edges, in vast commercial clusters served by highways. The commercial part of Buckhead, which not so long ago had seemed like the suburbs, was precisely that, an edge city, Atlanta's first. Then came Perimeter Center. Then Don Childress developed the Galleria out where Highways 75 and 285 crossed, and Frank Carter developed the Cumberland Mall, and another edge city grew up around them. All the edge cities were north of downtown and midtown Atlanta, and they were being built deeper and deeper into the immense ocean of trees. Already a new edge city was forming around Spaghetti Junction, and another one northeast of there, out in Gwinnett County, known as the Gwinnett Place Mall. Already Forsyth County, farther north still, had turned from a sleepy redneck red man chewing tobacco rural outback into subdivision heaven, and one of the three fastest-growing counties in the United States. Bango! Charlie had envisioned a new edge city, due west of Forsyth and north of the Galleria, in Cherokee County. It would be an edge city bearing his name, Croker. Did he dare open his eyes and look down? He didn't want to, but he couldn't help himself. Just as he feared, the G5 was in the perfect spot for an aerial view of Croker Concourse. There it was, the tower, the mall, the Cineplex, the hotel and apartment complex, the immense swath of asphalt, conspicuously empty, for parking, a preposterously lonely island sticking up out of that ocean of trees. Croker's Folly. Had to leapfrog the future, didn't you, Charlie? A few years down the line, somebody would make a fortune off what he had put together there, once the outer perimeter highway was built. But for now, too far north, too far from the old city, Atlanta itself. For now, saddlebags. His shirt felt sopping wet against his skin all over again, and his eyes, although he tried to avert them, stayed fixed upon Croker Concourse. Had to build a tower, didn't he? Had to take the name Croker soaring up 40 stories into the sky, with a dome to top it all off. You couldn't very well miss it, the dome, out in its splendid, leafy loneliness. The dome contained a planetarium and housed the Cosmos Club. Atlanta was big on private dining clubs in fancy high-rises, but there had never been one quite like this one. Into the club's domed ceiling, he had put a state-of-the-art astronomical light show apparatus developed by the Henry Buell Jr. Observatory at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Croker Global. Croker of the Cosmos. He had sunk $8.5 million into the thing, but it had turned out that nobody wanted to drive all the way out to Cherokee County for lunch and look up at a bunch of fake stars twinkling in the blackness of space while they ate their grilled yellowfin tuna on a bed of kale and Moroccan couscous or whatever it was Greater Atlanta yuppies ate for lunch. The Cosmos Club had been a hideously expensive bomb. Cosmos Club. Cosmic pinnacle of the great Croker Concourse. And there it was, right down there. When the G5 finally completed its turn and cleared the city and headed south over the green woods and farmlands of the Georgia Piedmont, he wasn't sorry. There was no more joy in looking down at Atlanta and its edge cities. Saddlebags. That they would have the gall, the temerity, the audacity to treat him, Charlie Croker, with such... Wismer Strook was no longer looking out the window, but straight at him, through his titanium frames. Charlie sighed and gave him a resigned smile, as if to say, "You know what's going through my mind, and I know you know it." And then, aloud, "Like I was saying, Wiz, got any good ideas?" Thanks to the G5's exquisitely muffled engines, a soft surf of sound, nothing more, enveloped the aircraft. The Wiz didn't even have to raise his voice. When he became intense, his voice didn't go up. Instead, a ditch formed down the middle of the forehead of his gaunt face. Wismer Strook was of the new breed of financial officers who came out of the business schools. Techno-geeks was what Charlie called them. But the Wiz could run the numbers, and he was a genius at the cross-functional integration of the different divisions of the Croker Global Corporation, two expressions he used all the time. And Charlie had become highly dependent on him. Good ideas vis-a-vis who, Charlie? Or vis-a-vis what? That was another thing Wiz said all the time, vis-a-vis. You never could figure out why.
How do I deal with these people, said Charlie. How do I approach them? Before, there was always Sycamore, who was a reasonable human being. But these people...
He gave his hands a little upward toss.
When I think of all the money we spent on Sycamore, all the times we flew him to Turpentine on this goddamn airplane, all the ball games, that weekend in Augusta, all the dinners we treated him to, him and Peep Gas, for that matter. Peep Gas.
He decided not to finish the sentence. He grew silent. I'm afraid that's a sunk cost, Charlie, said Wismer Strook. At this point, the whole paradigm has shifted. Charlie started to remonstrate. Most of the Wiz's lingo he could put up with, even a sunk cost. But this word paradigm absolutely drove him up the wall, so much so that he had complained to the Wiz about it. The damned word meant nothing at all, near as he could make out, and yet it was always shifting, whatever it was. In fact, that was the only thing the paradigm ever seemed to do. It only shifted. But he didn't have the energy for another discussion with Wismer Strook about techno-geek speak. So all he said was, "Okay, the paradigm has shifted, which means what?"
"Except for Peep Gas," said the Wiz. "Those were the bank's workout people, Charlie. Peep Gas is a loan officer, and Sycamore was in marketing. In marketing, they're incentivized to think of charm and customer satisfaction as value-adding strategies, but not in the workout department. What we're dealing with now is a division of the bank that has a very narrow niche focus."
Niche focus.
But he got the drift of it.
At the end of the day, they know they're going to be judged by only one thing: how much money they recover for the bank. Their orientation is post-goodwill. Down in Texas, after the oil crash and all the bankruptcies, the workout people the bank sent in were so niche-focused on that one thing, they started getting death threats. They'd call them up at their hotels in the middle of the night and threaten to execute them. A tired smile.
"Do any good? Worth trying?"
"I don't think it was a value-creating exercise," said the Wiz.
No doubt the Wiz was making his little joke, but you never really knew with this dour young man, because he always talked that way. Suddenly Charlie felt very angry.
"I don't give a damn about their orientation, Wiz. That fat little son of a bitch, he gave me the finger. He called me a prick. And did you see the way Peep Gas, did you see the way that little pussy?"
He gave up on that line of thought, too. A sixth sense told him it was useless to try to get into a discussion of Ray Peepgas's character with the Wiz. Peepgas wasn't a bad-looking guy, and he was probably bright, but he was soft. His head of thick, thatchy, sandy hair made him look 10 years younger than he was, but in a weak, boyish way. His neck and his chin and his cheeks and his hands were soft. To see that soft, weak face grinning at his expense, it had been infuriating. Peepgas was not strong, not fit, not manly. But the point would be lost on the Wiz. The Wiz was young and fit, but he was neither manly nor unmanly. He was a financial officer and a techno-geek. He ran 6 miles before dawn every morning, solely to keep the Wismer Strook cardiovascular system lubricated and tuned up for the long-term project, which was to live forever. As to whether Ray Peepgas was or was not a sad specimen of contemporary Georgia manhood, the Wiz would be completely uninterested.
Sure enough, the Wiz ignored the reference to peep gas and said, "The good news is they don't have many branches on their decision tree at Planner's Bank. I don't see that foreclosure is a viable strategic alternative for them. They've done a DFC, the same as we have. And if they foreclose, our operating losses become their operating losses. Cash flow is king." By now, Charlie knew that a DFC was a discounted cash flow. But exactly how you picked a number to discount it at, he never could figure out. "At the end of the day," the Wiz continued, "Planner's Bank will be willing to do anything other than be left having to manage Croker Concourse and 17 wholesale food warehouses. The net-net is they'll have to restructure the loans. But we can't stonewall them either. We'll have to give them something reasonably substantial, Charlie, just to buy some breathing space and get the best deal we can and recapture some goodwill. We lost a lot of goodwill because we didn't let them know about our situation soon enough." Charlie knew the Wiz wanted to say, "I told you so." For months he had been urging him to make a preemptive strike by alerting Planner's Bank to the cash flow situation. But he, Charlie, had been sure he could come up with something and pull it all out, as he always had in the past. After a pause, Charlie said, "Okay, we give them something reasonably substantial. Like what?" The Wiz looked at him through the titanium rectangles with his barcode scanner stare, and his lips parted, and the words didn't come out. He had withheld them. "Go ahead," said Charlie. He gestured encouragingly. "Well," said the Wiz, "I'm just thinking out loud. I'm not anticipating that you're going to like it. It's not something I want to see happen. I'm only considering our strategic alternatives. But what about the plantation?" Incredulous.
"Turpentine?"
"Well, I mean only in the sense that here we have a non-core asset, not functionally integrated into the rest of the corporation, and not creating any particular synergies, or at least not resulting in any strategic advantage, not in any zero-sum sense. And it's worth a great deal of money." The Wiz's diction was beginning to degenerate into sheer techno-geek-speak gibberish. Out of fear, he knew he had blundered onto dangerous ground with his boss. He tried to extricate himself. "I wouldn't want to see turpentine go either, but it's already a red flag as far as these people are concerned. You saw that. I mean, what do you suppose these people make a year? I bet that fellow Zale doesn't make $150,000, and he knows you've got a 29,000-acre quail plantation." That was evidently supposed to make him, Charlie, feel better, feel superior. But the very mention of the name Zale did the opposite. It sent a sickening wave of shame through his nervous system. This Zale, with his big jaw and contemptuous stares, had humiliated him in front of his own people. And obviously that fact was very much on the Wiz's mind. "Wiz," said Charlie, "I wouldn't give him the satisfaction. There's a lot of other reasons not to sell turpentine, but that's enough for now. They are not going to get the fucking satisfaction." "As I said, Charlie, I'm only trying to offer some constructive feedback. I'm only considering strategic alternatives. What about the planes?"
"I don't mind selling some of the planes. But we keep this one."
The Wiz exhaled and pulled in his chin. "That'd give them something, I guess. A bone, anyway, although I'm not sure they'd be terribly impressed. You saw what got them so aggravated." He lifted his hand up to eye level and then pointed his forefinger down several times toward the floor of the aircraft. Of course, the Wiz was right. Charlie knew that. And now he realized something else. Exactly why he was on this airplane at this moment, making a largely pointless flight to a South Georgia plantation on a Monday afternoon in April. He was damned if they, those insolent bastards at the bank, could tell him, one of the creators of Greater Atlanta, he couldn't have the G5 and turpentine, or, for that matter, the Cadillac SLS he had just driven himself and the Wiz out to the airport in. It was utterly, blatantly wasteful to crank up a ship like the G-5 and have two pilots and a stewardess hop to it in order to take two men down to Baker County, where they weren't going to do anything but talk, and then fly back. Well, so what? It underscored his rights, his power, his refusal to cave in to a lot of impudent threats. But there was something else also, something he fought to keep from becoming a conscious thought. The truth was, he had been afraid to return to the office immediately. He didn't dare return in a state of agitation. He avoided the word panic. To that grand space he had set aside for himself and Croker Global up on the 39th floor at Croker Concourse. Why had he taken an army with him over to Planner's Bank? 11 people he had brought along. Christ! By now the word was all over the office. Cap'n Charlie has just been humiliated. They ripped his eyeballs out and made him swallow them. Nothing like this had ever happened to Charlie Croker before. They had punched holes in his charisma, and now it was hemorrhaging all over the place. If he didn't pull himself together, the whole office would smell the blood immediately. They would detect it in the way he walked in, hobbling on his bad knee. Step, gimp, step, gimp, step, gimp. They would see it in the look on his face. They would suddenly see him as an old man, a toothless, eyeless, limping, gimping alpha lion. He had hired a lot of young hotshots over the past few years. The Wiz was one of them. He wanted to feel and look wired into the new generation. But the new generation wouldn't waste an ounce of sympathy. They'd start making telephone calls and drafting resumes. A real estate developer was not like an industrial CEO or an investment banker. No, you either had the aura of magic, fireproof confidence, and invincibility, or you had nothing. And right now he felt as if he was leaking fast, right down to charisma zero. He couldn't let them see him in this state. He had to regroup. He had to stop gimping around on an old, rusting football knee. Tomorrow morning, when he took the elevator up to the top of Croker Concourse, he had to look, sound, make every move of his alpha lion body, as if nothing had happened. Why hadn't he told the bastards off right then and there in that insultingly seedy excuse for a conference room? How could he have let them abuse him like that? What had happened? Was he truly getting old? Or maybe the explanation was more obvious. He was in a terrible jam. He had guaranteed $160 million in loans himself. It was madness. The Wiz had warned him against it. The cardinal rule of real estate development was other people's money. Non-recourse loans only. Never guarantee a loan yourself. But he had been so desperate to get financing for his Edge City, he had crawled way out on the forbidden limb. And he didn't have a single friend left at Planner's Bank. $160 million! They could seize everything he possessed on this earth, right down to the house he lived in and the cars he drove. Never in his entire life had he been in such deep water, deep slime, deep ooze, ooze creek, up ooze creek without a paddle. All of that smart guy's wisecrack started ricocheting around in his skull. Why hadn't he put that Zale or whatever his name was in his place, even if it meant walking around the table and breaking his fat jaw for him? Ah, this was esprit de l'escalier stuff, as the French say. The should-have-dones you think of on the stairs at night after it's all over. He opened his eyes.
What can I get you, Cap?
Gwinnett, the stewardess, was standing beside the desk, smiling. She had no idea what had gone on, of course. She wore a short-sleeved blouse with a repeat pattern of navy and gold Croker Global globes and a navy skirt. But beneath this corporate get-up,
She was a real country girl, young, plump, hearty, plain, no matter what she tried to do with her hair or her makeup. Plain was what he had been looking for this time. He had made a real fool of himself when Peaches was the stewardess on the G5.
"I don't know, Gwinnett," he said.
In fact, he was dying for a good stiff jolt of Jack Daniels in a short glass with ice and a little water. But at noon? He didn't want the whiz to know how much he needed a drink, how much he craved it. But why the hell shouldn't he have it if he wanted it? So he said, "We got any of Auntie Bella's biscuits on board, and maybe a little glass of Jack Daniels?" Auntie Bella was the cook at Turpentine, a real Baker County colored woman of the old school. And suddenly he had a terrible, sickening vision. How could he possibly look Auntie Bella in the eye one day and inform her that Cap'n Charlie was no more? Cap'n Charlie had blown it. He was flat as a tick. He'd lost Turpentine. And she was out of a job and would have to find a new home.
"We got 'em froze," said Gwinnett, "but they heat up pretty good."
"We got any of Uncle Bud's ham?" Uncle Bud was Auntie Bella's husband, who never had done anything but loaf around the kitchen and cure hams out in the smokehouse. He was an old man, but so erect and lordly that Charlie had always wondered if he wasn't the descendant of some African chief or something.
"We always got some of the ham, Cap," said Gwinnett.
Not only Gwinnett, but also the two pilots, Lud and Jimmy, called him Cap. They'd picked that up from the employees at Turpentine. The full Cap'n Charlie was a little too servile for Gwinnett, Lud, and Jimmy, he reckoned. But at the same time they admired him and felt too warmly toward him to use a cold, formal Mr. Croker. So they'd settled on Cap as the middle ground. He liked that.
"Well, then, let me have a couple of ham biscuits, too."
"How about you, Mr. Strook?"
"Oh, I'll just have a glass of Quibel." That was the Wiz for you, working 24 hours a day on Project Wiz, whose object was eternal life. Quibel was one of those bottled carbonated waters. Why anybody would want to drink carbonated water, Charlie didn't know, except that it was a New York fad that had seeped into Atlanta. Gwinnett headed back to the galley, and he had another sickening vision of having to look Gwinnett and Lud and Jimmy in the eye and inform them that their cap had been grounded. From now on, he'd have to be like the Viet Cong and travel on the ground and live off the land. He looked at the Wiz and said, "No, Wiz, they're not going to get Turpentine, and they're not going to get this airplane." Suddenly he had an inspiration. He cocked his head and gave Wiz a long, fixed stare, the way you do when you're about to say something of far-reaching importance.
"I got an idea, Wiz. If we're going to sell something to satisfy these bastards, why not do it upright? What if we sell the food division, the whole damn thing?"
To his surprise and disappointment, the Wiz smiled indulgently. And the Wiz was not a smiler. "I know it's never exactly captured your imagination," he said.
"It's worse than that," said Charlie. "The whole goddamn business is depressing. I can't stand going in those warehouses. They're so fucking gloomy. You want to know what's really depressing? It's seeing those poor bastards, what do they call them, the freezer pickers, coming out of those freezer units. I don't know if I ever told you. I was in the warehouse in St. Louis once, showing it to Harvey Moorhead, and this guy comes out of the freezer unit, and he's got two icicles hanging out of his nose. Icicles hanging out of his nose!" He shook his head. "I can't understand how I ever got involved in a business like that."
In fact, he understood very well. He had bought the old Maws and Gullet Food Service Corporation in 1987, and renamed it Croker Global Foods, at a time when many big developers, like John Harbert in Birmingham, were branching out into other businesses. Harbert had become a real tycoon. Everything was booming, and Maws and Gullet was on the market for a reasonable price. And along with the wholesale food operation, he would be acquiring a lot of good real estate, where the warehouses were located. And the name Croker, Croker Global Foods, would be on the sides of trucks and be spread all over the country. Terrific! But the business had no sex appeal. There was no way you could show a wholesale food warehouse to somebody and expect him to say, "Wow!" You could take somebody into the lobby of the tower at Croker Concourse, and even though the damned building was more than half empty and bleeding to death financially, the sheer curb flash would bowl him over. The Henry Moore sculpture out front, the marble arch over the doorway, the 50-foot-high ceiling in the lobby, the tons of marble on the floor and the walls, the Belgian tapestries, the piano player in a tuxedo playing classical music from 7:30 a.m. on. Whereas you take somebody like Harvey Moorhead to one of those warehouses, and he can't wait to get out of there.
"Well, Charlie," said the Wiz, "in my opinion, we have to learn to love it. Food service is not a business we can afford to get out of right now."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean that Croker Global Foods is the one part of the corporation where... Well, first let me give you a kind of executive summary of where we are now, okay?"
"Go ahead."
"Okay," said the Wiz. "If you've got assets with a market value of $2.2 billion and debts of $1.3 billion, then your net worth is $900 million, and you're rich, right?" "That's where we were in late 1989, 1990, and early 1991 even."
"Okay."
"But if you wake up one day and the market value of your assets has declined to $1.1 billion, and you still owe the $1.3 billion, then suddenly the paradigm has shifted and your net worth is minus $200 million. And it's a serious issue. And that's where we are today, all right? In the real estate business, market values can move up and down very fast. They're agile, they're flexible, they're terpsichorean." The Wiz made an awkward little flutter with his fingers to indicate terpsichorean. "But debt just sits there, like a rock formation, like a mountain. It doesn't budge. We're not in a cyclical downturn, Charlie. We're in a special situation."
"All right, but what's that got to do with the food division? It's losing money, too."
"That's true," said the Wiz. "But there are two serious impediments to selling it. First of all, it's so encumbered with debt that if we sold it now in this market, we wouldn't see a nickel of it. It would all go to the banks, and we'd still owe $100 million or so on it."
"Yeah, but the banks would get some cash, and maybe they'd leave us alone for a while and give us some room."
"Perhaps," said the Wiz. "But that brings me to impediment number two. The food division has lost value because the restaurant business is in a slump right now. But that is a cyclical downturn, and the industry will recover. Our warehouses are solidly positioned for the eventual upturn. People don't have to lease expensive office space in top-end buildings like Croker Concourse, but they can't defer their food consumption function."
"Can't defer their food consumption function?"
"They have to eat. Every day."
"All the same,
Charlie, what's the personal dividend you're taking out of this corporation each year? $7 million?
Charlie nodded glumly. It was true. The annual outflow of what he spent personally had become a form of madness. After taxes, after the $50,000 a month to his first wife Martha, after the endless fantasies in furniture, clothes, travel, servants his second wife Serena managed to come up with, after the house on Sea Island, the house on Blackland Road, the stable and 40 acres in Buckhead up near the Cobb County line where he went riding, he couldn't figure out where it all went. It sure as hell didn't go into stocks, bonds, municipals, treasuries, or the mattress. And that didn't even include turpentine, most of which was billed to Croker Global Foods. Shit! He hadn't even thought of that. Without the food division, he'd have to swallow the cost of turpentine himself. He couldn't very well bill a plantation to Croker Concourse.
And of that 7 million, do you know how much comes from Croker Global Foods, Charlie?
4.
The cash flow of the food division is more than Croker Concourse and our other buildings put together. The food division is the engine that drives the cash flow of the whole corporation.
All right, said Charlie, you've made your point. The engine that drives the cash flow. Give me a break.
Oh, he understood the Wiz a lot better than the Wiz thought he did. The Wiz looked upon him as an aging, uneducated, and out-of-date country boy, who had somehow nonetheless managed to create a large and, until recently, wildly successful corporation. That the country boy, with half his brain power, should be the lord of this corporation, and that he, a Wharton MBA and financial genius, with an excellence that cuts across disciplines, to use a Wizism, should be his vassal, was an anomaly, a perversity of fate, that would in the long run be corrected. He had youth on his side. In the meantime, his resentment rose and fell, and he took a sharp pleasure in rubbing in the old man's ignorance with these little lectures. Or part of him felt that way. The other part of him was in awe, in unconscious awe, of something the old boy had and he didn't. Namely, the power to charm men and the manic drive to bend their wills into saying yes to projects they didn't want, didn't need, and never thought about before. The common word for this was salesmanship, a term the Wiz probably looked down his nose at. Yet the Wiz was in awe of something that was at the heart of salesmanship when the game got up into the hundreds of millions of dollars, and it was time to make a decision and act. Make your move! Even though you could run the numbers all day, and they added up only to imponderables, and the decision tree was so full of branches, twigs, sapsuckers, and leaves, a mere Wiz couldn't find the paradigm no matter how hard he looked. And that thing was manhood. It was as simple as that. Charlie looked at the Wiz, sitting there on the other side of the Tupelo desk, beneath N.C. Wyeth's painting of Jim Bowie at the Alamo, and he said to himself, "My motto is ready, fire, aim, and you give me lectures and make sly fun of me about that. But yours is ready, aim, 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 aim." He turned away and looked out the window and let the surf of the engines roll over his nerve endings. Down below. Startled, he put his nose up against the window and stared. It was breathtaking. A glorious cloud of pink seemed to cover the earth. A peach orchard, in full blossom. A huge one, gorgeous beyond belief. We must be down around Thomaston. Wonder who owns it. Gwinnett reappeared with his glass of Jack Daniels and his 2 ham biscuits and the Wiz's glass of carbonated water and set them down on the desk. Charlie noticed the way her plump lower abdomen, which was about at his eye level, swelled out against her navy skirt. How old was she? 24 or 5, he figured. As soon as she headed back to the galley, he said to the Wiz, "How many warehouses we got in the food division? 17?
"That's correct, 17.
"What's the payroll?"
"For all the warehouses? For the entire division?"
"Yeah, the entire division."
"I don't have the number on the tip of my tongue, but I can do a back-of-the-envelope calculation."
He produced an HP-12C calculator from the side pocket of his jacket, and the ditch down the middle of his forehead deepened, and he began pecking away. That damned HP-12C was the Wiz in hardware form. It was the wizard's wand of the techno-geeks. Charlie couldn't stand the sight of it because it utterly baffled him and made him feel how cut off he was from the new generation coming out of the business schools. Curious about the thing,
He had once asked the Wiz to let him try it for a second. He tried to enter 2+2. He couldn't get 4. Couldn't get 2+2=4. Turned out that with this damned machine you had to enter +2++2. It worked backwards or something. Only people with MBAs from Wharton could even get it to function. In no time the Wiz looked up and said, 207,375,000 in round numbers, give or take 25,000. Jesus, that's a lot of money. Am I right? That's true. What if we cut the payroll by 20%? How? What type of initiatives? Across-the-board layoffs? Right, what would we save? Well, $40 million. But I don't see how we could do it. I'm not aware of any inefficient fits in the employment situations in the warehouses, and the Teamsters would go crazy. They're all Teamster shops. I can deal with the Teamsters. They have a practical streak. Are you serious? 20%? I don't know. That's an awfully deep cut, Charlie. The restaurant business is way down, volume is way down, and I don't recall any layoffs to speak of. Maybe, but I've never gotten any indication there was any real slack at the warehouses. Well, let's find out. Let's try it. I don't know, Charlie. 20%? That's 1,200 people. The word people, as opposed to the words they had been using, payroll and employment situations, jarred Charlie for a moment. You're probably right, he said. That is a lot. What about 15%? We'd still save 30 million, right? And we'd be talking about only 900 layoffs, which is fewer than 1,000. It won't look so drastic, and it'll impress the hell out of the bank. You know why?
Why?
Because banks can't stand paying money to employees. To them, giving money, that sacred thing, money, giving money to people, just to spend on themselves, that's practically immoral. Layoffs are right on their wavelength. The Wiz arched his eyebrows and rolled his eyes, but said no more. He looked out the window, and Charlie followed his gaze. Down below, amid a swath of orchards, you could see a house on a low rise with a long, long, long curving driveway leading up to it. The driveway was bordered on both sides by a parade of dogwood trees, planted so close together that their profusions of blossoms created two glorious trains of white, stretching on for what must have been half a mile. Christ! Must cost a fortune to keep up a place like that. And bango! You could lose it all before you knew it. And then where would all those heavenly bowers be? Now, while the Wiz continued to stare out the window, Charlie looked at N.C. Wyeth's painting of Jim Bowie, which made him think about his mama and his daddy and the shack he'd grown up in. Baker County had been so rural, there had been only one town, Newton, big enough to make it onto the S.O. roadmap. There hadn't been many places for poor white people to work in Baker County other than the plantations and the pulp mill. His daddy had worked at Itchawe, the plantation owned by Robert Woodruff, the president of Coca-Cola, right there on the Flint River, and at Turpentine and two or three other places. None of them stayed for very long, and then he went to work at the pulp mill. He'd lost the index finger of his right hand working in the pulp mill. That was the worst job in Georgia. Just going over to the mill to see his daddy was like going to see a horrible freak show of men with fingers and eyes missing. A bunch of Teamsters working in a modern warehouse for $12 or $14 an hour, with forklifts to do the heavy lifting, and OSHA regulations and God knows what else. Croker Global Foods was a country club compared to real work. Just as if it were yesterday, he could see that godforsaken pulp mill, and he could hear it, with the saws and the rippers screaming and whining, and the geysers of sawdust spewing up from the blades, and the chips flying, and those poor crippled bastards working like dogs, his daddy among them. Some of them had an eye and a finger or two missing. He could see the pitiful stumps. Aha! Was that the real reason he had suddenly thought of his daddy and the pulp mill, the missing fingers? He could feel his lips compress and his face turn red, just thinking about the insolent son of a bitch with the chin, giving him the finger, and making the crack about losing four fingers in the war. He had seen men with missing fingers, his own daddy for a start, and he'd actually been in a war. In the early years of the war in Vietnam, he'd won the Purple Heart and the Bronze Star with a Combat V. And he was willing to bet money that the cute guy with the big chin had never even served in the armed forces. He'd have the Wiz or Marguerite or somebody check the guy out. He was tempted to say something to the Wiz right now about that son of a bitch, and who had or had not experienced combat, but he restrained himself. Nobody wanted to hear war stories from a 60-year-old man. The two of them sat in silence a moment longer, ruminating. Just then the door to the cockpit opened, and the chief pilot, Lud Harnsberger, came out and beamed at Charlie and said,
"Well, Cap, everything okay? About to begin the descent?"
"Yeah, everything's fine, Lud." Charlie liked everything about Lud Harnsberger. He was from over in Cobb County, near Marietta, which he pronounced Mayretta. He was one of those big, tall, blonde Georgia boys who are lean and strong, but have such thick, fair Anglo-Saxon skin you don't see any muscular definition. He was wearing a short-sleeved white shirt and a navy necktie with the Croker Global logo embroidered on it in neat rows, and the sunlight lit up a furze of reddish-blonde hair on his big forearms. Charlie always liked that, the way that ever-so-delicate furze of hair lit up like spun candy on his pilot's big, thick forearms, although it was the kind of thing you couldn't mention to anybody. Lud had spent 4 years in the Air Force flying transports. Fighter planes would have been better, but the main thing was that he was a good old Georgia boy who had put in his time in the armed services. Charlie liked the way Lud looked at him and spoke to him. Lud didn't fawn, but Charlie could always tell that he respected him as a man, not just an employer.
"I just talked to Durwood on the radio, Cap. The Range Rover's broke down, so he's going to come on out to the Strip and pick y'all up in the Suburban. Andy Bella's going to have some kale and sausage soup and some hot biscuits ready when you get there."
"Well, that's great, Lud," said Charlie. And now Gwinnett was standing beside him again.
"Get you something else before we land, Cap?"
"No, thanks," said Charlie.
"How about you, Mr. Strook?"
The Wiz just shook his head no. Gwinnett's hips and forearms were at Charlie's eye level, and once more he was aware of the way her lower abdomen swelled out against her skirt. She was pretty plump, but her skin was lovely, absolutely smooth and flawless. It looked like milk, the way milk looks when you milk a cow and it comes right out of the udder. He had never noticed that before. She was stout, a real country girl. There had been an animal vitality about these broad-beamed country girls when he was growing up, something marvelous and robust. The juice really flowed. Pop! He forced himself off that train of thought. What the hell did he think he was doing? Suppose he made a play for the likes of Gwinnett. How long could that last? 24 hours? 24 minutes? And then he would have lost a good stewardess. Gwinnett was heavy-set, like Martha. A little wavelet of guilt and remorse. 29 years he'd been married to Martha, before Serena. Christ, Serena. Not even 30 yet, and already tough as whit leather. Tough as whit leather. How the hell had that expression floated into his head? His daddy used to say it all the time. Never could figure out what whit leather was. He closed his eyes and thought about Peaches and hoped he'd feel a tingle in his loins. He had a theory. If you lost your sexual drive, you lost everything.
your energy, your daring, your imagination. He kept waiting for the tingle. Instead, he felt an electrical jolt in his solar plexus. Suppose it happened. Suppose they took everything from him. They could wipe him out. He was 60 years old, and this time they could wipe him out. Utterly. Desperately, he looked up at the bulkhead again, at Jim Bowie on his deathbed. A brave, brave man, brave as they come. And he never said die. Yeah. And a few minutes later, he was dead as they come, with a Mexican bayonet through his heart. And, no doubt, they took everything he had, including the Bowie knife, while they were at it. Beneath his sternum, Charlie Croker's heart was hurrying as if it had an urgent appointment somewhere else. Blood was banking the ship toward the east. They were coming in to Turpentine. Down below, for as far as you could see, stands of soaring longleaf pines with riots of white dogwood blossoms running through them. Tawny fields of sedge, just beginning to turn green, interspersed with copses of already brilliant green spreads of beggarweed, Egyptian wheat, rye, oats, peas, and corn. Huge groves of live oak, only just beginning to burst into leaf, so that you could make out the arthritic trunks and branches and the shaggy garlands of Spanish moss strung